So I'm here for that last session on Eric Voegelin's Science, Politics, and Gnosticism. It took me a while to get to this concluding session. This is a little book. It's got a lot in it, and that's why it took me this long. And also the fact that there were several other things going on, lots of Moran Academy stuff. So before I get started on this, I do need to show you something. This is our latest newsletter. If you subscribe to our free newsletter, you'll get some increasingly interesting articles, and you will get all of the announcements of our upcoming classes. This is such a deal, actually. I've never really put it this way before, but it occurred to me the other day. For $5 a month or $10 a month, you can have access to everything that we do, all of our sessions, either recorded and or live. And we're doing more and more. And I mean, this is what we all enjoy, right? Not being told you have to have a lot of homework, you have to read a ton. Of course, we love readers and we've been reading quite a bit ourselves. We have this section here on the website that shows you the kind of books that we're reading in the moment, the co-founders of the Moran Academy. But we know that people come from a lot of different backgrounds and walks of life. And so what we offer is a good, enjoyable education over time in areas that are of concern to a lot of people. There's a couple of new members that we've gotten recently. And most importantly, what's coming up right around the corner is a one session class with James Murphy on Peter Moran and the Mondragon Corporation, which is a cooperative corporation in Spain that I believe is now has gone international. It's big anyway. And it's built on principles, solid principles of profit sharing. So you'll want to come for that. It will be live on Zoom. Like I said, the easiest way to avail yourself of all of this is just to become a patron of the Moran Academy. And then at the $10 level, you would get to see that talk live on Zoom and get the recording. For $5 a month, you get the recording of everything we do. So you'd be able to see that. I think that's going to be really interesting. It shows you there are different ways to do business. There are more equitable ways that are actually very successful. Then we have a class coming up. It's going to be co-taught by Spencer Hess and myself on The Unsettling of America, a classic book by Wendell Berry. We're really excited about that. We've also got a session on the Universal Destination of Goods, Deacon Chris May, and that will be coming up November 28th. And that is a concept about private property. It's a Christian teaching about property that you will want to hear. And then we have further out sessions on the gift economy with Miriam Dominguez. And we have, hopefully coming up in the future, a class on modern monetary theory. And if anybody could do it, it would be Jacob. And then maybe also a session on Swifties, which is something I definitely want to see. So think about all that. Sign up for our free newsletter. Check out our website. And get more involved. We need your support. We want you on board. You are the reason why we're doing all of this. So please take the time to check it out now. But as of the moment, I have to get back into Eric Voegelin. And as some people requested, give you my thoughts on this little book and all of Voegelin's ideas. The book that I have been reading is called Science, Politics, and Gnosticism. And what I want to do in this session is sum up the key thoughts of Voegelin on Gnosticism. Obviously, by now, if you've watched the whole series or if you haven't, go back and watch the rest, it's clear he's not using Gnosticism in the way that you might have learned it if you took a class on, you know, the history of religion or spirituality or something like that. Yes, he references the ancient Gnostics, and he is trying to identify a pattern of human thought through that, the Gnostic pattern of human thought, which he thinks can then be applied to other times and even to non-spiritual matters that become strangely spiritualized when you apply this pattern of thought. So I'm just going to briefly sum up the six characteristics of Gnosticism as Voegelin defines them in this broader sense that allows us insights on political and other mass movements of our day. So he says, first, the first step is the Gnostic becomes dissatisfied with his situation. There's a problem in the world. There's something impacting the person that draws their attention and makes them dissatisfied with their current conditions. Then secondly, he says, the Gnostic believes that, quote, the drawbacks of the situation can be attributed to the fact that the world is intrinsically poorly organized. Okay, so step two, if you think about it, it could be different, right? The person might say, well, the problem is inherent in the world. Okay. And, you know, I may not like it, but maybe part of the reason I don't like it is because I can't adjust. Or one could just say, this is the way God made it or the way it's supposed to be, and I will have to adjust. But instead, the Gnostic is dissatisfied and then begins to critique the world at a pretty deep level, saying that it is intrinsically poorly organized. So it is a critique of the world. It's not accepting it as is, which means implicitly a critique. If one is a believer in God, it's a critique of God, because God, of course, from that perspective, created the world, right? So that's step two. Step three involves the belief that salvation from the evil of the world is possible. Okay, this is a belief that's shared with, say, Orthodox believers of various kinds and the Gnostic, that salvation from the evil of the world is possible. But for, say, Christian believers, that salvation comes usually in death, right? The full resolution, or with some sort of second coming, in which God restores everything, right? So this is a step that every one of them takes, but the Gnostic will take it in a different direction. So fourth, he says, the belief that the order of being will have to be changed in an historical process. From a wretched world, a good one must evolve historically. This assumption is not altogether self-evident, because the Christian solution might also be considered, namely that the world throughout history will remain as it is, and that man's salvational fulfillment is brought about through grace in death. All right, so there you have him contrasting what he sees as the Gnostic view versus the Christian view. Now, it depends on what kind of Christian you are, I think, as to whether that the second half of that paragraph actually would seem true to you, because there are versions of Christianity that do think very much so that there's going to be a historical process, you know, that leads to the second coming, and certain things have to happen in the world in order to make that happen, the ultimate, right? So the pattern, I think one could say, the pattern is somewhat even within Orthodox Christianity, and then the offshoots even more so, various offshoots that are very into like the whole historical projection, the historical trajectory leading to the ultimate conclusion. I think Voegelin would say those interpretations of Christianity are misguided and Gnostic, right? And therefore not Orthodox when they get to the point of seeing, say, that certain political things in the world have to happen, and, you know, certain things have to be fulfilled in a political and social sense in order for, say, Christ to return. I think Voegelin would argue that this is making the Gnostic turn, and it's a mistake. Okay, so that's number four. Number five, he says it involves then the belief that a change in the order of being lies in the realm of human action, that this salvational act is possible through man's own efforts. So if we were to speak of Christians who believe that certain political things have to happen in order to make Jesus return, then maybe they would need to get involved in making sure those things happen, right? Or maybe more importantly for Voegelin, at this point, you start to see the potential for Gnostic ways of thinking in secular thought. that secular thought merges with this sort of religious Gnostic way of thinking. Okay, at this very point, when it occurs to people that through human effort alone, we can reach our own salvation. Okay. So, from having listened to this series, he is aiming primarily, he's aiming his arrows at the secular mass movements, such as communism, fascism, okay, those in particular. I've pointed out he doesn't really see liberalism in the same light. Maybe it could be applied to the whole liberal trajectory as well, though, the liberal ideology. And in fact, probably you could apply it somewhat to any strong ideology, right? It's a belief system. It's a belief that human beings can, through their own effort, make the world work, make it well organized. Whereas previously, in an earlier step two, a person realized, wait, the world is not well organized. So this is where they say, well, with our, scientific management skills, with the correct, education, with the correct ideological focus and commitment, we can change all that. Okay. So surely, for sure, Voegelin thinks communism did this. And I think this is why he hammers so hard on Karl Marx. And then sixth, he says, it becomes the task of the Gnostic to seek out the prescription for change, for such a change. Knowledge or gnosis of the method of altering being is the central concern of the Gnostic. So the Gnostic's going to develop the method, whether it's that scientific management method, whether it's the, education, which will change the way people think, some sort of social engineering is what we're talking about here. Okay. And so this is the secular modern Gnostic pattern of thinking. We get to the stage where the chief concern is the development of special knowledge that is often kept amongst those who know, right? So for instance, in the Bolshevik Revolution, the smaller group of people who's particularly ideologically charged, right, is able to move forward as a sort of vanguard, as they put it, a leader class that will lead everybody else into this. And he says, ultimately, at the end, we have a construction of a formula for self and world salvation, as well as the Gnostic's readiness to come forward as a prophet who will proclaim his knowledge about the salvation for mankind. So you can see how now at this point, say somebody like Mao here would be that Gnostic prophet claiming to have that special expert knowledge. And I realize that's ironic because Mao was very much against the experts and for the Reds, as he put it. But he would be that expert whose wisdom, Mao knowledge, right? Mao intelligence in his books, in his speeches, and in his decisions would lead everybody else into this new salvation, this new world in which everything is made right. These types of pictures from this era are just, they speak volumes. It is the vision of a perfectly happy, unified people under one banner and one leader. So this is what Voegelin is talking about. And I find these ideas useful. I don't find them unique. I think Carl Jung, whom I've spent a lot of time on in my research, as well as on this channel, had some of the same thoughts at around the same time. And I don't know if they ever crossed paths. And they are not alone. As time has gone by, I have become aware that the 20th century was kind of full of intellectuals who had this thought that ideologies were becoming more or less secular religions, that they adopted this kind of pattern, and that the result was, and this is important to say, they think, and I think this is borne out, the result was a high level of destruction, because when it came right down to it, people who have gone down this path discover that other people and the world itself will not conform to these high heavenly idealistic dreams, right? That, and for Voegelin, one of the things that Christianity offers, and I think we could expand this to other religions as well, if they're properly understood, they put man in his place in between, right? In between the highest order, the transcendent, the godly realm of perfection and hell, ultimate debased, you know, depravity. Okay. That is the proper position, because that's the level of our attainment, right? So when the Gnostic leader tries to mold people into perfect, whatever it is, in this case, perfect, you know, communist subjects, or in the case of capitalism, you know, perfect workers and nothing more. By the way, listen to my last conversation with Jeff Bilbro from the Front Porch Republic as a reference there, right? When we train people to be just perfect workers and nothing more, and we deem them not suited for an education in history and in philosophy and literature, well, we're committing somewhat the same error. We're trying to turn people into little building blocks, material building blocks for some grand vision for somebody else. Okay. So it's different, and yet it's not different from this communist vision, right? So Voegelin is saying the only sane position that will keep people from going down this path is to remember that they are in between, and that the world is given, that the world is not poorly organized. In fact, we have to take it as well organized, and then we need to look at how we can sort of conform to its reality and our reality. Human beings are made in a certain way. We keep trying to push against that, and we get into trouble. And of course, this leaves us with the question, well, what do you do with human genius, with all of those good ideas, right? I think this can still exist and still do people a lot of good. Voegelin's position adds, not to be too simplistic about it, but it adds a sense of humility, and limitedness that people need in order to make their technology, their political ideas, actually do more good than harm. Now, how you get there is another question, as always. You know, thinkers don't have a lot of solutions on hand. Fighting for people, including everybody, to have access to knowledge, to a basic good education that involves more than just learning how to be a worker in either a communist or capitalist paradise, is a building block of what we probably need, right? There probably isn't any substitute for people changing interiorly to some extent. We've tried to organize people from the exterior, and it doesn't work. Going along with all of this, remember that in this book, he goes on at length about the sin of foreclosing to questions. And he makes the point that Gnostic movements work and seem to make sense only if people stop asking questions. Well, in our world, since even highly educated people don't get trained broadly, it's almost impossible to ask those questions. It's becoming more difficult for people to ask those questions, and for the people who do ask those questions to be taken seriously. Questions of a spiritual nature get hived off from, you know, questions of a material nature. Questions of a human nature, a moral nature, get hived off from those of a technological nature. And this is killing us, literally. We have climate change, which is threatening us more than ever before, maybe largely because we've hived off our moral and spiritual existence from our technological and money-making existence. So to train people in the right way, to form them, as Jeff Bilbro put it, is really important. If people want some change to happen, maybe they should start there, in insisting that young people and people generally have access to knowledge, and not just access, because people might not know. I mean, the internet's full of knowledge, but you have to sort through it and you have to know what to do with it. So this foreclosure to questions, this is a sort of clue. You know, when people say to you, well, that's just, you know, not fashionable, that you can't say that, that's silly, that's, you know, almost embarrassing. You know, why would anybody talk about this? You know, whether it's a religion or a moral question, or an environmental question that you have, if somebody's trying to shut you down, they were probably trying to create a closed loop system in which no outside ideas can penetrate. This does not help human beings adjust and deal with the reality of their situation. Okay. So he would be very much for openness to ideas. He says the Gnostic movement does not lead to the erotic opening of the soul, but rather to the deepest reach of persistence in the deception, where revolt against God is revealed to be its motive and purpose. I find even today that a lot of religious people are very closed to knowledge. They're afraid that certain types of knowledge will somehow damage their souls or will destroy the world that they're living in. For instance, knowing something about Nietzsche or Marx, which they treat like a taboo, literally, in a technical sense. And, you know, they're suspicious of contrary ideas, as though their closed loop system could not withstand the penetration of these ideas. So the job then is to keep them out. That is a position of weakness. And it basically says, we believe in something like a bubble that will burst with a pinprick. But that is not a good belief system then. And when it comes to Christianity, we can do better than that. It doesn't have to be a bubble. It is not so weak that one errant thought will push it down. I'm kind of a little bit on a crusade at this point about this. You know, we should not be afraid to learn any and all ideas. And when we are, this is a sign that we have become Gnostic and we have created this closed loop system, and then we are stuck in fear and in strange kind of delusionary hope as well, that we can somehow control our whole environment and our whole world 100%, which when you think about it from the Christian perspective is a massive moral error, let's say. If he read him, you should be able to read him too, and everything else. All right. By the way, next time I will be delving into Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, and particularly his teaching on friendship. So grab your Nicomachean Ethics if you want to read it. Otherwise, you'll hear about it, and I'll see you next time. Bye.